And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is August 3rd, 215th day of the year. Leap year, 216th day in the Gregorian calendar. 150 days left until this year is over with. And a lot of people wish it would get over with quickly. Well, in the year 8, Roman Empire General Tiberius defeats the Dalmatii on the River Bosna. A.D. 70, fires resulting from the destruction of the Second Temple in Jerusalem are extinguished. 435, deposed ecumenical patriarch of Constantinople, Nestorius, considered the originator of Nestorianism, is exiled by Roman Emperor Theodosius II to a monastery in far-off Egypt. 881, Battle of Sacourt en Vimeo, Louis III of France defeats the Vikings. An event celebrated in the poem Ludwigslied. 908, Battle of Eisenach, invading Hungarian force defeats an East Frankish army under Duke Burchard of Thuringia. 1031, Olaf II of Norway is canonized as St. Olaf by Grimkatel, the English Bishop of Selsey. 1057, Frederick von Lotharingen elected the first Belgian Pope, Stephen IX. 1342, the Siege of Algeciras commences during the Spanish Reconquista. That was when Spain took the country back from the Moors. 1492, Columbus set sail from Palos de la Frontera in Spain for the New World, don't you know? He sailed the ocean blue. 1527, the first known letter from North America sent by John Rutt while in St. John's, Newfoundland. 1601, Austria captures Transylvania in the Battle of Goroslo. 1645, 30 Years' War, the Second Battle of Nordingen, sees French forces defeating those of the Holy Roman Empire. That was before the French learned, if anybody points a gun at you, raise your hand and scream, "We surrender." 1678, Robert LaSalle builds Le Griffon, the first known ship built on the Great Lakes. I think it vanished. Nobody really knew what happened to it. 1778, the Theatre La Scala in Milan is inaugurated with the premiere of Antonio Salieri's Europa Reconstruita. 1795, the Treaty of Grenville is signed, ending the Northwest Indian War in the Ohio country. 1811, the first ascent of Jungfrau, the third highest summit in the Bernese Alps by brothers Johann Rudolf and Hieronymus Meyer. 1829, the Treaty of Lewistown is signed by the Shawnee and the Seneca peoples, changing land in Ohio for land west of the Mississippi River. 1852, Harvard University wins the first boat race between Yale and Harvard. Race is also the first American intercollegiate athletic event. 1859, the American Dental Association is founded in Niagara Falls, New York. 1900, the Firestone Tire and Rebel Company is founded. 1903, Macedonian rebels in Kruševo proclaim the Kruševo Republic that exists for 10 days before the Ottoman Turks come in and just stomp the crap out of everybody. 1907, Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis fines Standard Oil of Indiana record $29.4 million for illegal rebating to freight carriers. The conviction fine later reversed on appeal. After all, what good are you as an international company if you don't have a few senior judges in your pocket? 1914, Germany declares war against France while Romania declares its neutrality. 1921, Major League Baseball Commissioner Kennesaw Mountain Landis confirms the ban of the 8 Chicago Black Sox the day after they were acquitted by a Chicago court. 1936, Jesse Owens wins the 100-meter dash, defeating Ralph Metcalf at the Berlin Olympics. Upset Hitler no end. 1936, the fire wipes out Krusha 2 in the Mashero lowlands. Ryazan Oblast, Russia, kills 1,200 and leaves only 20 survivors. 1940, Italian forces begin the invasion of British Somaliland. 1946, Santa Claus Land, the world's first themed amusement park, opens in Santa Claus, Indiana. 1948, Whitaker Chambers accuses Alger Hiss of being a communist and a spy for the Soviet Union. 1949, the Basketball Association of America and National Basketball League finalized the merging of a create the National Basketball Association. Interestingly enough, based on local ticket sales, or recent ticket sales, I think they've pretty much come to an end as well. 1958, the world's first nuclear sub, the Nautilus, becomes the first vessel to complete a submerged transit of the geographical North Pole. 1959, Portugal's state police force, the PIDE, fires on striking workers in Bissau, Portuguese Guinea, kills over 50 people. 1960, Niger gains independence from France. 1972, the U.S. Senate ratifies the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. 1975, a pervertly chartered Boeing 707 strikes a mountain peak and crashes near Agadir, Morocco, kills 188. 1977, Tandy Corporation announces the TRS-80, one of the world's first mass-produced personal computers. I had one of those. It was a phenomenal little thing. I found a card that would allow me to eavesdrop on the signals being sent from overseas news bureaus to their headquarters in New York. And that's when I first learned how thoroughly our news is monitored, I guess is a word. Tandy was Radio Shack. I think it's pretty much gone the way of the dodo now. 1981, Sinhalese opposition parties under the leadership of Mamadou Dia launches the Anti-Imperialist Action Front. 1997, Oued El-Had and Mazarara massacre in Algeria. 116 villagers wiped out. 40 in Al-El-Had and 76 in Mazarara. 1997, the tallest freestanding structure in the Southern Hemisphere, Sky Tower in downtown Auckland, New Zealand, opens after 2.5 years of construction. 2004, the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty reopens after being closed since the September 11th attacks. 2005, President of Mauritania, Maula Abd Sid Ahmed Taya, is overthrown by a military coup while attending the funeral of King Fahd in Saudi Arabia. 2007, former Deputy Director of the Chilean Secret Police, Raul Iturriaga, captured after having been on the run following a conviction for kidnapping. 2010, widespread rioting erupts in Karachi, Pakistan after the assassination of a local politician. 85 are dead, at least 17 billion Pakistani rupees, that's about 200 million U.S. in damage. 2014, a 6.1 magnitude earthquake kills at least 617 people, injures more than 2,400 in Yunnan, China. 2018, two burqa-clad men killed 29 people and injured more than 80 in a suicide attack on a Shia Mosque in eastern Afghanistan. 2019, 600 protesters, including opposition leader Lyubov Sobol, arrested in an election protest in Moscow. 2019, 23 people were killed and 23 injured in a shooting in El Paso, Texas. That happened at the Walmart. In fact, he took the parking place my wife and I vacated. Had we been a little slower, I would probably have said something about a guy wearing hearing protection and carrying a rifle across the parking lot. But then again, this is El Paso. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays. Anniversary of the killing of Bejaguiti in Ghana and Bissau. Armed Forces Day in Equatorial Guinea. Christian Feast Day, George Freeman Bragg, W.E.B. Du Bois in the Episcopal Church. Lydia of Thyatira, Mira Bears in the Lutheran Church, Nicodemus, Olaf II of Norway. This is the transition of the relic. Stephen, discovery of the relic. Wathelaw of Melrose, Flag Day in Venezuela, Independence Day. In Niger, celebrates its independence from France. Also Arbor Day in Niger, National Guard Day in Venezuela, International Beer Day. Gotta have a day dedicated to beer. No way around that one. Let's see what else we got. Fabricius, David Fabricius discovers light variation of Mira, first variable star. 1914, Germany invades Belgium, declares war on France, starts World War I. 1934, Hitler emerges the office of German Chancellor and President, declared himself Führer on this day in history. Let's see. Elisha Otis's birthday, Stanley Baldwin, Martin Sheen is 80 years old. Martha Stewart is 79. Let's see what else we got. Okay. Yeah, that doesn't work. Let's try one more time. Okay. We'll get there, folks. Well, I think that, it's National Watermelon Day, National White Wine Day, New Brunswick Day, New South Wales Bank Holiday. Okay. British Columbia Day in Canada. Let's see. Heritage Day in Alberta, Canada. Natal Day. Northern Territory Picnic Day. Terry Fox Day. Tom Brady's birthday. Well, I think that is what we've got for today. And for those who are into zodiac signs, this August 3rd is a falls under Leo. And the most compatible signs with Leo are Aries, Gemini, Libra, and Sagittarius. The least compatible signs with Leo are generally considered to be Taurus and Scorpio. Okay. All that haven't been said, let's talk about more strange crimes. In 2006, a Florida chiropractor named Rhonda Schroeder began dating New York Mets pitcher Pedro Martinez. They met through a patient of Schroeder's named Shirley Gordon. When Martinez kept encouraging his new girlfriend to give Gordon gifts of hundreds of thousands of dollars as a reward for the introduction, she eventually realized that her boyfriend probably wasn't a real Pedro Martinez, and she called the police. Well, he wasn't. He was arrested, Shirley Gordon was already wanted by police on identity theft charges. But it was a good run while it lasted. Well, in 1995, NFL Hall of Famer O.J. Simpson was found not guilty of murdering his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ronald Goldman. Now, Simpson may have been legally acquitted, but the court of public opinion found him guilty. His career as an actor and pitchman was over. And in a 1997 civil suit brought by Goldman's family, Simpson was found liable in the deaths in order to pay Goldman's family $33.5 million. Initially, Simpson managed to avoid paying because California law protected his NFL pension. But the Goldmans didn't back down, and in 1999, Simpson auctioned off his Heisman Trophy and other memorabilia to pay the Goldmans $500,000. And to avoid paying more and to escape a back tax bill in excess of $1 million, Simpson moved to Florida to protect his estate. Now remember, he was searching for the real killers on every golf course in the country. In December 2001, FBI agents searched his Florida home after getting a tip he was involved in a drug trafficking ring. Now, they didn't find any narcotics on the premises, but they did discover O.J. was pirating cable. He had to pay tens of thousands of dollars in fines and legal fees. A year later, he was caught speeding a 30-foot powerboat through a wildlife protection zone and got hit with another fine. But despite all his various run-ins with the law, he was still a free man. Then on the night of September 13, 2007, Simpson and a group of men burst into Bruce Fromm's room at the Palace Station Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas. I know that place. Spent a couple of nights there. Simpson was convinced that Fromm, a sports memorabilia dealer, had stolen some of his NFL mementos. So after grabbing a few items, Simpson and the group left. Following day, he told a Los Angeles Times reporter he wasn't a suspect. He said, "I'm O.J. Simpson. How am I going to think that I'm going to rob somebody to get away with it?" And then he said, "I thought what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas." Well, unfortunately for Simpson, one of his accomplices actually brought a tape recorder to the crime. So the NFL star was arrested a few days later on charges that included robbery and conspiracy. And he was found guilty on all charges and sentenced to prison in December 2008. But the judge offered him a little bit of leniency. Demanded that 8 of the 10 counts run concurrently for a maximum sentence of 33 years. So he served 9 years in prison and got released in late 2017. The real killer of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman hasn't been found, though I read a couple of books that claim that it was a drug deal gone bad. You know, there's a movie out called Scream. The villain in Scream is based on a Florida serial killer known as the Gainesville Ripper. Well, let's talk about the Gorilla Killer. Between February 1926 and June 1927, Earl Leonard Nelson murdered 22 women, all boarding house landladies in various locations across the U.S. and Canada. He was convicted of two of these murders and executed by hanging in Winnipeg, Manitoba in 1928. Well, apparently, his nickname was the Gorilla Killer. And the exact story of how he got this nickname appears to have been lost in the pages of time, but there are a number of versions passed around today. Now, one suggested he got the name because of the strength he exhibited in carrying out his crimes. He strangled all his victims with his bare hands. Now, I might point out gorillas aren't known to practice strangulation. But since when do facts interfere with a good story? Another story says he had a severely receding forehead and large protruding lips and very large hands, the combination of which made him look like a gorilla. Well, then there's the oddest version of the story. Investigators interviewed Nelson's aunt during his killing spree, and she told him as a young boy he'd been struck by a trolley and sent into a coma for several days. After he woke up, he suffered periods of mania, during which he would curl up his legs and walk around on his hands, which made him look, she said, like a gorilla. Well, no one ever really knew the real reason, but the stories are good. Well, in April of 2005, 18-year-old Nicholas Buckaloo of Morrisville, Vermont, decided he wanted to make a creative and unusual bong. Now, a bong is a large marijuana pipe. Late one night, he broke into a cemetery, broke into an above-ground tomb, took the skull from a buried body along with the eyeglasses and bow tie that were with it. Police said he told his friends he's going to bleach that skull and make a pipe out of it. Well, unfortunately, if you're going to commit a crime, you don't tell your friends. 2006, he pled guilty to intentionally removing a tombstone and intentionally carrying away the remains of a human body. He was sentenced to 1 to 7 years in prison. Well, it's often been said a boy's best friend is his mother. And Robert Bloch's 1959 novel Psycho, and in the 1960 Alfred Hitchcock film that starred Anthony Perkins, innkeeper Norman Bates impersonates his dead mother and blames her for the crimes he commits. Now, that was on the screen. In real life, in 2003, Thomas Parkin of New York City pretended to be his deceased mother so he could keep collecting her Social Security and benefits. Even wore a wig and sunglasses and painted nails when he went to the DMV to renew her license. 2009, when police finally arrested him, he said, "I held my mother when she was dying and breathed in her last breath, so I am my mother." Police didn't really see it that way. Well, I'm sure you've heard the slogan, "Take a bite out of crime." In 1980, the nonprofit National Crime Prevention Council hired an ad agency, Saatchi & Saatchi, to create a kid-friendly mascot and a slogan. A copywriter by the name of John Keel considered a lion who roars at crime and an elephant who stomps out crime, but finally opted for a dog who takes a bite out of crime. Well, inspired by TV's Columbo, artists drew the dog as a grizzled gumshoe and a trench coat. Character appeared in public service announcements, with Keel providing the voice, urging kids to report any crime they witnessed, from bullying to drug dealing. Dog wasn't named until a 1982 contest. New Orleans police officer suggested McGruff the crime dog, the number two on the list of suggestions was Sherlock Bones. The National Crime Prevention Council says that 75% of American children today recognize and trust McGruff and know the slogan. So I guess you could say that the fight against crime has gone to the dogs. Well, you know, one of my main complaints about having to deal with people in officialdom is they get the idea they're somehow royalty. So what do you do when you combine a robe, a gavel, and delusions of grandeur? You probably have an El Paso court, but that's an entirely different story. While presiding over deliberations on a drunk driving case in Lakewood, Washington, Municipal Court Judge Ralph Baldwin disappeared into his chambers and came back a short time later with a 12-pack of beer. He invited the attorneys, the jurors, and the court staff to stay for a cool one, but said, "Don't tell anybody, and I'll deny it if you repeat it." Afterwards, he brazenly carried an open container of beer in his car, telling onlookers, "I might as well drink and drive. I do it all the time anyway." Well, Judge Baldwin later admitted he made the statement, but claimed he was joking the beer can was empty. When I thought about it later, I thought, oh my God, you're a fool, he said. Well, that's true, because it got back to the powers that be. While running for re-election in 2008, Philadelphia Traffic Court Judge William Singletary, also a church deacon, attended a Blessing of the Bikes Motorcycle Club gathering at Philadelphia Park. If you all give me $20, he said over the PA system, you're going to need me in traffic court. Am I right about that? Now, y'all want me to get there. Video footage of the deacon's attempted bribe found its way to YouTube and into the authorities. Well, he was eventually charged with 4 counts of misconduct and found guilty on all 4. That was enough to cost him his judgeship. Elizabeth Halverson, a Clark County, Nevada District Court judge, took the bench in January 2007. In her first few months on the job, the state's Judicial Discipline Commission got more than a dozen complaints about her behavior. They alleged that Halverson abused court staff with racial and religious slurs, sexually harassed the bailiff and made him feel like a houseboy by assigning him menial personal chores, hired a computer technician to hack into courthouse email accounts, made false statements to the media about 3 other judges she believed were conspiring against her, fell asleep on the bench during 2 criminal trials and ordered a clerk to swear in her husband so she could question him under oath about whether he'd completed his chores at home. She reportedly asked one court employee, do you want to worship me from near or afar? 6 months into her judgeship, Halverson was suspended and charged with 14 counts of judicial misconduct. 2008, she was removed from the bench for life. I got a long list of other judges that ought to be removed from the bench for life. Well, in 1996, for some Lord only knows why reason, there were a lot of violent criminals with the middle name of Wayne. Conan Wayne Hale confessed to his priest he killed 3 people. Michael Wayne Thompson escaped from prison, was the subject of a multi-state manhunt. He was a convicted murderer. He was captured in Indiana. Danny Wayne Owens murdered his neighbor in Alabama. L.S. Wayne Faulkner, executed for the 1981 murder of a college student. Larry Wayne Cole died while running from the law on rape charges. Well, you know, there's been a lot in the news about whistleblowers. Let's talk about the toilet seat whistleblower. A. Ernest Fitzgerald, a top civilian Air Force auditor in the U.S. Department of Defense, testified before Congress in 1968 that $2 billion in cost overruns had occurred in the military's Lockheed C-5A cargo plane program. He said he'd been reporting this to his superiors for over 2 years, and he took no action and pressured him not to testify. When he did testify, they retaliated by stripping him of his civil service tenure, saying it had been awarded to him erroneously due to a computer error. Then his department was restructured to eliminate his position, and he was demoted to minor investigations, including cost overruns at a bowling alley in Thailand. Well, Fitzgerald, who was a U.S. Navy veteran, fought back by filing suit, and after 4-year battle was reinstated in his original position. Well, he continued to report cost overruns and fraud. Now, the Reagan administration threatened employees with loss of their job and security clearances unless they signed a gag order. Fitzgerald refused and beat back the order, which was eventually withdrawn. His greatest fame as a whistleblower came in the 80s when he revealed that the Air Force was being billed $200 for hammers, $7,622 for coffee pots, and $640 for toilet seats. He wrote a book in 1972 called The High Priest of Waste and the Pentagonist, an insider's view of waste management and fraud and defense spending in 1989. In 2006, he made a lot of people happy by retiring from the Department of Defense. Well, you know, sometimes the least expected person is actually labeled as a criminal. How about Grandma Meth Head? Now, many states restrict or ban the sale of cold medicines that contain the ingredient pseudoephedrine because it can be used to make crystal meth. In Indiana, you can buy only a certain amount of pseudo ephedrine-based medicines in a 7-day period. But 70-year-old Sarah Lee Harpole didn't know that. In 2009, she bought a box of Zyrtec for her husband who had allergies. A few days later, she bought her adult daughter some Mucinex D for a cold. Well, even though folks are being murdered in her bed, the police zeroed in on her. Clearly, she was a meth head. So she was arrested for intent to manufacture crystal meth. They later dropped the charges, but you got to wonder about people. Well, even famous people, those that consider themselves above the rest of us, can be criminals as well. Case in point, Naomi Campbell. On her way to the Toronto movie set of Prisoner of Love in 1998, the supermodel was delayed by Canadian custom officials. Finally arriving at her hotel, the diva blamed her assistant, Georgina Galanis, for the wait, grabbed her by the throat, and slammed her against the wall. Still furious at her, Campbell reached for a telephone and hit Galanis twice in the head with the handset and threatened to throw her from a moving car on a busy highway. Toronto Criminal Court ordered Campbell to take anger management classes, and you gotta wonder, did she learn anything? Because according to news reports in 2001, she attacked another assistant. But when you're royalty, you can do that and get away with it. How about Marilyn Manson? The gender-bending rock star made headlines in September 2003 when a Minnesota jury found him not guilty of battery or any of the other charges against him, such as causing emotional stress, mental anguish, and humiliation. Charges resulted with a stunt during a 2000 concert. Security guard David Diaz was working in the front of the stage when Manson suddenly grabbed him and began rubbing his pelvis against Diaz's head. July 2001, while performing in Michigan, Manson pulled the same stunt on a security guard named Joshua Kiesler. This time he had to pay a $4,000 fine. And Russell Crowe, of course, being the near god that he thinks he is, in 1999, while spending some time on his 560-acre ranch in Australia, Crowe and his brother Terry went out for a drink and wound up in a brawl. Crowe spied radio DJ Andrew White at a local bar, approached him and said, "I've listened to your program and it's crap." White's fired back, "So are most of your movies." At that point, Crowe turned to the DJ's wife and said, "I'm going to belt the crap out of your husband." And then he went after White and several other bargoers. Security cameras captured him in three separate fights, kicking, punching, and biting like a wild man. During the battle, Crowe even took a swing at his own brother before biting a bouncer on the neck and fleeing the bar. And, you know, interestingly enough, Crowe once attacked the director of the British Academy of Film and Television Arts show for editing a four-line poem out of Crowe's Best Actor acceptance speech. Witnesses said Crowe's own security people had to remove him, kicking and cursing and fighting. You know, my position would be, if you can't behave yourself, stay home. Well, you know, the most disturbing and diminishing thing about a lot of crooks is their collective IQ, or lack thereof. People describe the failed Smart Mart heist in Greentown, Indiana, as a string of blunders. Blunder number one, when the four robbers, all men in their 20s, forced the clerk and three customers into a back room, they failed to check and see if the customers had cell phones. One of the customers called the cops, who showed up sooner than the robbers expected. Blunder number two, one of the crooks dropped his credit card at the scene, which eventually led detectives to the criminal mastermind's headquarters. And blunder number three, the trailer, where their headquarters was, had a surveillance system. And that surveillance system had recorded the criminals preparing for and returning from the heist. Police actually had more evidence than they needed to charge the robbers with several felonies. I have to wonder, in the middle of a crime, why would you pull out your credit card? You gonna buy something? Well, a life-size fiberglass horse was the perfect topper for Bruce and Ellen Weatherton's new shop in Central Point, Oregon. The shop was called the Horse Blanket Saddles and Tack. Now, today, that horse is a well-known landmark, but back in 1983, when they first opened a store and put the horse on the roof, some pranksters decided that horse needed to come down. One day, at about 2:30 in the morning, Bruce got a call from a deputy to come get your horse. He's in the middle of the street. Well, what really upset Bruce was the fact the horse thieves used a hacksaw to cut the horse off at the ankles. He told the Medford Mail Tribune all four nuts were loose. All they had to do was undo the nuts. So Weatherton brought the horse to a vet, or I guess you could say a repair shop, and paid nearly as much to get it fixed as it cost him in the first place. Not long after it went back up, he said, "I'll be damned if the kids didn't go back again." And this time they actually broke the poor horse's legs, which cost even more to repair. But they weren't giving up. The only way to save the horse was chop down the walnut tree the pranksters are using to get up on the roof. Well, you'd think that would solve the problem, but apparently it didn't. The perpetrator simply climbed up an elm tree next to an adjacent building. So the elm was cut down as well. And since that time, the horses stayed up on the roof. Well, sometimes crimes become extremely well known, one of which is one of the most widely publicized kidnappings of the 20th century, and that was the Lindbergh baby kidnapping. On May 20th, 1927, Charles Lindbergh completed a nonstop flight of 33 and a half hours from New York to Paris in the Spirit of St. Louis. He became a national hero. He married New Jersey heiress Ann Mora, and they had a son, Charles A. Lindbergh Jr., nicknamed the Eaglet. March 1st, 1932, they stayed a few extra days in their Hopewell estate, which is accessible only by a private airfield or a winding dirt road. At 8 o'clock in the evening, the nurse tucked little Lindy into bed in his second floor nursery. At 10, when she checked on him, he was gone. After searching the estate, Lindbergh called police to report his son had been kidnapped. When the police arrived, they found a chisel and a handmade extension ladder outside the house, and there were footprints on the ground. In the nursery, Lindbergh discovered an envelope with a note, and the note, which was misspelled, said, "Have $50,000 ready. After 2 to 4 days, we'll inform you where to deliver the money. We warn you for making anything public or for notifying the police the child's in good care." The note's signature, two interlocking red circles with three holes punched in the design, would be an indication of correspondence from the kidnapper. Well, when news of this crime got out, reporters and gawkers were immediately trampling the Lindbergh estate and destroying potential evidence. Police hadn't taken cast of the footprints, and the throngs ruined the chance to cast them. One of many citizens offering to help the Lindberghs was Dr. John Jaffe Condon, a retired principal living in the Bronx. He declared himself willing to negotiate with the kidnapper, and amazingly, he got a letter accepting his mediation offer, marked with the kidnapper's signature. Now, Lindbergh authorized the inexperienced, and a lot of folks said suspicious, Jaffe to negotiate on his behalf. Condon got more letters from the kidnapper and also got the Eaglet's pajamas. Following the kidnapper's orders, Jaffe went to a Bronx cemetery August 2, 1932, and delivered $50,000 in gold certificates to a man with a foreign accent that became known as Cemetery John. Well, in return, Jaffe got another letter that claimed that the little boy was alive on a boat named the Nelly. A search ensued, but the Nelly was never found. May 12th, the truck driver went into the woods to relieve himself and discovered the remains of a toddler that was believed to be the son of Charles Lindbergh. The coroner deduced it had been lying in the woods since the time of the kidnapping. 1934, police got a lead to the kidnappers. A gas station customer paid with a gold certificate the attendant thought might be counterfeit. So he wrote down the customer's license plate numbers and called the cops. Police checked the serial number on the certificate and found out it was part of the Lindbergh ransom. This led authorities to Bruno Hopp, a carpenter from Germany. He was an illegal immigrant whose description actually matched that of Cemetery John. Police arrested him, but they found more than $11,000 in the ransom money. But not all of it. Well, you ever heard the expression, it's about the ride and not the destination? Well, police in Ferrol, Spain charged Antonio Navarro with driving while intoxicated on the highway. Now, he was only doing 12 miles an hour, and he wasn't driving a car. See, Navarro's a quadriplegic, and the police busted him driving his motorized bed down the freeway. So where did he need to go in such a hurry? Well, he really didn't want to initially say, but eventually he confessed he was on his way to a local brothel. He got a discount for bringing his own bed, apparently. Police in Newark, Ohio arrested a 28-year-old by the name of Kyle Weigel for drunk driving in 2009. But he wasn't driving a car. He was driving a motorized bar stool that he had built himself. And he was the one who actually called the police. You see, he was drunk, lost control of the stool, fell off, and he called 911 for medical assistance. Well, instead of the paramedics arriving, the police arrived. They never reported what happened to the bar stool. What about 4 o'clock one morning in 2009, an 18-year-old British Army soldier stationed in northern Germany decided to steal one of his squadron's tanks. Broke into the 8-ton Scimitar tank and made it about a third of a mile before the vehicle ran off the road and got stuck. Well, not to be stopped. He returned to the base and stole another tank. This time the British military police followed him, blocked the soldier's path, forced him to swerve, and he crashed into a tree. Nobody ever said where he was going. Well, Ozzy Osbourne has for a long time been known as the Prince of Darkness. He used to bite the head off bats, I think it was, on stage. Well, in November 2007, hundreds of people around Fargo, North Dakota got letters containing invitations to a party. The invitation was printed on purple stationery and had images of spiderwebs and skulls on it and came from a company called PDL Productions. Well, they weren't your average party invitations. They were for a party at a Fargo nightclub with British rock legend Ozzy Osbourne. So he was performing at the Fargo Dome later that night, so the invitees were also promised backstage passes to the show. Well, 44 invitees showed up at the club and were immediately arrested. It's all part of a sting set up by Fargo Sheriff Paul Laney. That's what the PDL stood for. He had a specially made invitation sent to hundreds of people at outstanding arrest warrants. When Osbourne heard about the stunt, he apparently was not amused. He said, "The sheriff should be ashamed of himself for using my celebrity to arrest these criminals." Lady later said he didn't mean any respect for Mr. Osbourne, added that several of his deputies had gone to his show after the bust. Well, 1859, Senator David Broderick of California, he was a power broker behind the Democratic Party's anti-slavery faction, was challenged to a duel by political enemy and pro-slavery activist David Terry, California's Chief Justice. They dueled at Lake Merced, south of San Francisco. Broderick had the first shot, but when his gun misfired, Terry calmly put a bullet through his chest. So Broderick now has the unique distinction of being the only U.S. senator to be killed in a duel while in office. Now, Terry was tried for murder and acquitted. 1889, the elderly Terry was gunned down by the Supreme Court Justice Stephen Field's bodyguard after Terry confronted Field in a train station restaurant and slapped him. Well, in 1917, a war protester named Alexander Banwart and two other men confronted Massachusetts Senator Henry Cabot Lodge in his office. And they wanted Lodge to vote no on the upcoming resolution to enter World War I. Well, the words coward and liar were spoken, and then the 67-year-old senator got up and decked the 36-year-old pacifist and laid him out cold. Protester was arrested, but Lott said he was too busy to press charges. 2 days later, Large voted with the majority of his fellow senators to go to war. Well, Ben Warrant later caught the patriotic fever gripping the nation. After announcing he'd changed his mind, he enlisted in the Army. Well, Ed Koch at one point was New York City mayor. I got the opportunity to meet him when we lived there, and he was an interesting character. One of the statements for which he's known is, "Life is indeed precious, and I believe the death penalty helps to affirm that fact." Well, that's probably true. Well, let's talk about Charles Whitman, the sniper in the tower. Looked like a regular clean-cut guy. Born in Lake Worth, Florida in 1941 to a well-off family, he went to Catholic schools, excelled at piano playing, and became an Eagle Scout at the age of 12. But in spite of all that, it was not the perfect family home. His father, who everybody calls C.A., abused his wife and wasn't much nicer to the kids. Even when Charles was 18, his father continued to beat him for what he saw as transgressions. Well, in 1959, Charles Whitman enlisted in the U.S. Marines. Proved himself a model Marine who excelled at following orders and earned a good conduct medal, a sharpshooter's badge, and the praise of observers who said he was an expert at long-distance shooting, particularly when his targets were moving. In other words, he was a sniper. Well, Whitman enrolled at the University of Texas in Austin to study engineering, but he struggled with his studies. Met his wife Kathleen there, and the two got married, but that didn't settle him down. He bounced in and out of the university over the next few years. At one point, he was ordered back to military service due to poor college grades. Well, in 1963, he was court-martialed after threatening another soldier to whom he'd loaned money. Sentenced to 30 days behind the bars and 90 days of hard labor and stripped of his rank as well. He was a lowly private again. Miserable, he turned to his hated father to pull some strings to reduce his enlistment period. His father succeeded, and Charles was discharged from the military in December of 1964. Well, after getting out of the military, he returned to Austin. He was depressed and anxious about his inability to live up to his own standards. Visited the university's health center in March and reported to the attending doctor he felt like a failure and despised his father. Said he fantasized about going up on the tower with a deer rifle and shooting folks. Well, the doctor didn't take him seriously and prescribed Valium to help him calm his nerves. Well, July 22nd, 1966, Whitman paid his first visit to the tower to stake it out. On August 1st, shortly before noon, Whitman arrived on campus and talked his way into the tower. On the 28th floor observation deck, he took his place and picked up a scoped rifle he had put there. Within 90 minutes, he'd killed 14 and injured 31 more. After 2 hours of this, police officers finally made their way to the deck and shot him dead. In a note he left behind, he said he killed his mother and wife too, which was true, and he was prepared to die. The tower was closed for 25 years after the shooting, but reopened in 1999. Said nothing about whether he did anything to his father or not. Well, marijuana has interesting effects on people. In February 2011, Joel Dobrin, 32, of San Diego, California, was driving down a road in Sherman County, Oregon. Some marijuana and a hashish rode shotgun on the front seat of his pickup truck. Well, he was pulled over by a sheriff's deputy as the officer was approaching the car, and Dobrin grabbed a sock lying on the floor of the truck and stashed his drugs inside it. But his dog, a pit bull, grabbed the sock and started playing tug of war, and the sock flew out the open window of the truck. the sheriff's deputy simply picked up the sock and found the drugs. Later on, the sheriff's spokesman said, "I wish everybody traveled with their own personal drug dog. Make our job a whole lot easier." Robert Watson was driving down an East Haven, Connecticut road late one night in April 2011. Came across a police sobriety checkpoint. When police checked, they found marijuana in his car. And he was arrested for possession of marijuana. Blood tests found he also had a small amount of cocaine in his system. Unfortunately for Watson, he was a member of the Rhode Island House of Representatives and had a record of stridently opposing marijuana legalization and voting for stiff penalties for drug offenders. Well, he got what he supported. Well, Mata Hari is known to history as the exotic dancer who loosened many lips in the service of the Germans during World War I. That may well not have been true. See, he was born in 1876. Met husband-to-be Rudolph McLeod through a personals ad, and after that joined him at his post in faraway Java. Few years of living on Java, she fled to Paris to begin her exotic dancing career. And Parisian audiences flocked to her titillating performances. She was even booked into a few Italian opera houses. Well, by 1915, when she was 39 years old, her career was fading fast. She was doing less dancing on stage and more horizontal boogie with men in her bedroom. Recently unearthed French files revealed dozens of Mata Hari's clients, including German military attaché Major Arnold Cayley. Now, that affair was probably the one that got her killed. In 1917, Mata Hari was arrested by the French and accused of spying for the Germans. And they produced decoded messages outlining a German plan to hire her as a spy. Now, not only were the French unable to produce any evidence of secrets she handed over, but high-ranking French officers testified she had tried several times to give information on German activities to the French. Well, she was convicted of spying and executed in 1917. Now, rumor said she opened her blouse to distract a squad from firing. In actuality, she went bravely to her death with her blouse completely buttoned up. Well, sometimes things don't end as we think they're going to. On a sweltering summer afternoon in 2017, a burglary suspect was jumping from rooftop to rooftop in Wapunti, California neighborhood. Chase ended when the cops had the suspect trapped on the roof of a one-story house. Now, police weren't sure of the man's mental state, so they didn't want to risk a forceful takedown. They thought he might jump off the one-story house. So they called in a crisis management team, and a standoff ensued. But no matter what the team tried, the man refused to budge. He sat on that roof for 5 hours. And that's when Willard Burgess decided he'd had enough. The 83-year-old resident of the house told officers that sucker's coming down. Went to his neighbors, grabbed a ladder, and before police could stop him, climbed up on the roof. Burgess yelled at the burglar and told him to get off his roof, and the burglar refused, so Burgess pushed him off. When he hit the ground, deputies took him into custody and into the hospital. The report didn't say what happened to Burgess. Well, sometimes justice is quick. In this particular case, the defendant was John Kracken, a Texas personal injury lawyer, and the crime was flaunting his wealth in public. In 1991, Kracken represented a disabled widow in a lawsuit against her husband's employer, the Rock 10 Company. As a recycling company, the man was killed in a baling machine. Kracken sued for $25 million. But Rock 10's case was so weak, there was talk the jury might award as much as $60 million. Shortly before deliberations were to begin, some of the jurors happened to spot Kracken in the courthouse parking lot. He was driving a brand new red Porsche 911. Well, the jury awarded Kraken's client only $5 million. When asked why they awarded so little, the one juror said, "There ain't no way I'm buying that lawyer another fancy car." Sometimes it happens. Well, let's talk about a trial that's stranger than anything you would see on court TV. In 891, Pope Stephen V turned to Duke Guido III of Spoleto for protection because the Catholic Church was losing power as the Roman Empire disintegrated. To cement the relationship, Stephen adopted the Duke as his son and crowned him Holy Roman Emperor. Well, Pope Stephen V died a few months later, and a new pope, Formosus I, was elected to head the church. And Guido was suspicious of the new pope's loyalty. He insisted Formoso's son Guido, Formoso named Guido's son Lambert heir apparent. When Guido died in 894, Formosus backed out of the deal. Rather than crown Lambert as emperor, he called on King Amulf of East Francia to liberate Rome from Guido's family. A year later, Amulf conquered Rome and Formosus made him emperor. Well, relationship didn't last long. Just a few months. But within that few months, Amulf suffered paralysis and returned to Germany. A few months after that, Pope Formosus died. But Lambert, who had retreated back to Spoleto, used the crisis to rally his troops and march on Rome. And he reconquered the city in 897. The new pope, Stephen VI, switched sides and crowned Lambert as emperor. Well, what happened next is one of the most peculiar episodes in the history of the Catholic Church. Eager to prove his loyalty to the Spoletos, Pope Stephen convened the Cadaver Synod, in which he literally had Pope Formosus, 9-month-old rotting corpse, put on trial for perjury, covering the papacy and a number of other crimes. On Stephen's orders, the cadaver was disinterred, dressed in papal robes, and propped up on a throne for the trial. Since the body was in no condition to answer the charges made against it, a deacon was appointed to answer questions on its behalf. Well, not surprisingly, the cadaver was found guilty in all accounts. As punishment, all of Formosus' papal acts were declared null and void. The corpse itself was also desecrated. Three fingers of the right hand used to confer blessings were hacked off, and the body was stripped naked and dumped in a cemetery for foreigners. Shortly after that, it was tossed in the Tiber River, where a hermit fished it out and gave it a proper burial. Well, while the synod was still in session, an earthquake struck Rome and destroyed the papal basilica. Taking this as a sign of God's anger with the upstart pope and encouraged by rumors that Formosus' corpse had begun performing miracles, Formosus' supporters arrested Stephen and threw him in the papal prison where he was later strangled. Sometimes things don't work out the way we think they're going to. It's just a fact of life. Well, let's look at some more proof that crime doesn't pay. Residents of a Portland, Oregon neighborhood were concerned about an alleged drug house. They had tried numerous times to get the police to investigate, but to no avail. Then in late 2011, somebody in the area saw a flyer tacked to a pole, took it down, brought it to the cops. That was all they needed to secure a warrant. When officers raided the house, they discovered marijuana, heroin, an sawed-off shotgun, thousands of dollars in cash, and the materials to put together a meth lab. So what did this flyer say? Heroin for sale, and it listed the address. Well, we've come to the end of another show. We'll be back tomorrow night. But once again, you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a truly great evening.